Okay, this object is a view of the two principal components of the science instrument assembly for gravity probe B, namely the gyroscope and the star tracking telescope, both of which are made from fused quartz and operate at cryogenic temperatures. In addition to the talks this morning, there will be 22 poster presentations this afternoon on various aspects of gravity probe B. There are many people to acknowledge. It was a cast of about 1,000 from beginning to end, and I can only put up a few names up here. This is the current core team at Stanford, and also included Don Davidson, who was very instrumental in the design of the star tracking telescope and showed us how to fabricate the gyroscope housing with fused quartz, which is quite a difficult feat. The NASA Marshall Space Flight Center provided overall program management and provided a lot of technical assistance as well. Lockheed Martin provided the vacuum probe and superfluid helium doer and also the spacecraft. And we had support from many other individuals at various institutions, too many to tell you at this point. And we were funded and supported by NASA. Francis Everett gave this overview yesterday. We take a gyroscope and put it in orbit, a polar orbit around the Earth at an altitude of 642 kilometers. We then spin the gyroscope up, pointed toward a guide star, IM Pegasi. And we are looking for two precessions of the gyroscope due to general relativity, the geodetic effect, and the frame dragging effect, which are 6.6 arcs, milliarc seconds per year and 39 milliarc seconds per year, and they're at right angles so they can be separated from each other in the measurement. Now, the instrument's purpose is to measure the direction of the gyroscope with respect to the apparent position of the guide star. And the guide star, as seen from the satellite, includes the orbital and annual aberration of starlight, the parallax, and proper motion. Now, the experiment, the satellite experiment, only measures the apparent position, and a separate experiment measures the proper motion, which was described yesterday by Erwin Shapiro, using very long baseline interferometry. Now, the purpose of the experiment is this, we have to do the following to make this measurement. We want to have an instrument which can measure the precession of the gyroscope to an accuracy of about a half a milliarc second per year. And this means we have to have very low disturbance torques so that the principal motion of the gyroscope is those due to the geodetic effect and the frame dragging effect, and we also have to have an instrument which can resolve these very small angles. This is an overview of the instrument. It's conceptually very simple. There's a metrology bench which is formed by a fused quartz block. On the front end, there's a star tracking telescope. Then there are four gyroscopes, each of which measure the two precessions independently. So we have four separate measurements of each of the two precessions. The gyroscopes are go down into cylindrical holes, and when they're installed, the four gyroscopes, the center of them, form a line which is parallel to the telescope axis. The gyroscope readout is actually solidly attached to this metrology bench, and then in turn we have the star tracking telescope attached to the metrology bench, and so the measurement of the position or orientation of the gyroscope is with respect to the telescope axis. We then point it toward the guide star, and we can't quite point it exactly, but within a few milliarc seconds in inertial space. And so we take the telescope signals and we subtract those from the gyroscope signals to get the net direction toward the star. This whole system operates at 2.5 Kelvin because we use a superconducting magnetic readout. And a very important feature of this instrument is that it rolls about the line of sight to the guide star. Three important facts result from this. One is that the inertial pointing signal is not at zero frequency, but is at the roll frequency, which is 77.5 seconds. The roll also averages body fixed classical disturbance torques toward zero, and it reduces the effect of body fixed pointing biases. So if the system bends just a very small amount, this is taken out by the roll. Now I will go through a series of charts which show the flight hardware and the requirements that were placed on this flight hardware. This is the gyroscope. The gyroscope is the size of a ping pong ball made from very homogeneous fused quartz, and it is very spherical. It's overcoated with a thin layer on the order, a little under a micrometer, of niobium, which is superconducting at low temperature. The mass and balance of this gyroscope is the requirement is less than 50 nanometers. The mass and balance is the difference between the center of mass of the gyroscope and the center of support, which is basically the center of the sphere, which are displaced slightly from each other because of the properties of the materials. And the sphericity, or asphericity, is to be less than 25 nanometers. This is placed inside of a fused quartz housing shown here. There are two halves. This is the readout half. This is the spin-up half. There are six circular electrodes, which we use to capacitively determine the location of the gyroscope in the housing. And then we apply voltages to those electrodes to force it to the center. There's also all the other surfaces are covered with a titanium coating, which we ground to protect the gyroscope from the charges that build up in the fused quartz. So it acts as a Faraday shield. Here is the spin-up channel. Helium gas flows in here and goes along the spin-up channel, and there's an exhaust hole which you cannot see, and when the gas flows through this channel, it spins the gyroscope up. The superconducting readout loop is on this side of the, on this half. It's a four-turn loop, and the connections to it are located right here. In addition, the system has an ultraviolet electric discharge system using the photoelectric effect. This is the assembled gyroscope, showing the various cables to connect to the electrodes and other features. This is a view of the DC squared readout system. A spinning superconductor, fundamental property is that it has a magnetic moment. And when it can be seen in this form, for a sphere, the magnetic moment is a dipole moment, and there are shielding currents or superconducting currents on the surface. And one can represent this, although it's not quite correct, but it is correct in terms of the flux that is seen in this loop, as a uniform B field interior to the superconductor. And so you can immediately see that the flux increases in the loop as the gyroscope recesses away from the plane of the readout loop. So initially, we spin up the gyroscope so that the spin direction is in the plane of the readout loop, and there is no flux through the readout loop. The gyroscope then, and the readout loop is in the is lined up with the telescope axis, and so the as the gyroscope recesses away from the plane of the readout loop, you have flux through the loop. We then rotate the whole system is rolling, and so the loop rolls around the line of sight of the guide star, and so this flux becomes a sinusoidal signal, which is a measure of the angle of the gyroscope, and the phase tells whether it's in which axis it's in, the phase of the sinusoidal signal. The loop is connected to the DC squid. The DC squid is shown here in its package with the cover removed. And there is a superconducting strip line, which is shown here, connecting the loop back to the squid. And it has very low inductance, and the coupling, the connections are shown right there on the housing. We have to have very, now the need for this system is that we resolve 1 milliarcsecond in 10 hours of observation. And this means at the signal frequency, at roll, we need to have a noise level of less than 190 milliarcseconds per root hertz. And we also have to have very low trap flux, because that also contributes to the magnetic signal and therefore to the scale factor for angle. For that reason, we need a magnetic shielding system with residual field of less than 9 microgauss and a very large attenuation, if you put it in the other terms, 5 × 10⁻¹⁰ attenuation, or a factor of 2 × 10⁻¹২, depending upon how you express it. This is the photograph of the Flight Star Tracking Telescope. It's a Cassegrainian system, and the light from the star enters from here through a forward plate, a flat optical plate. It then impinges on a primary mirror. There's a secondary mirror up on the back of the forward plate. There's a tertiary mirror, and the image appears at an image divider assembly at this location, which I will talk about later. And the need for this system is to have a readout noise of less than 34 milliarcseconds per root hertz, and we want a pointing accuracy in inertial space of less than 1/10 milliarcseconds. This is the science instrument assembly. Here's the fused quartz block, the telescope in the front, and the 4 gyroscopes installed in the 4 cylindrical holes. It's about a meter long. We then take the science instrument assembly, we install it in the vacuum probe. This is a vacuum shell of aluminum, which is at low temperature. This is all at approximately 2 Kelvin. And the science instrument assembly is located under the vacuum shell, right about in this region. This is a neck region where you transition from 2 Kelvin up to the ambient temperature of the space vehicle. Here are all the various connections to the cables that go down to the instrumentation. There are 4 windows so that the telescope can observe the guide star. And the top window is a single crystal sapphire window, which closes out the vacuum. And then there are 3 fused quartz windows, which intercept the thermal radiation coming down the neck so that very little thermal radiation reaches the instrument. This vacuum probe also incorporates a low-temperature ultra-high vacuum bakeout system to get less than 10 to the minus torr after spin-up and bakeout, and I'll describe that more fully later. We then take the vacuum probe and we install it into the liquid helium doer. This is the vacuum shell for the liquid helium doer. Here is the top of the vacuum probe with all of the cables connected, and this doer incorporates a superconducting lead bag, which provides a 1/10 microgauss region for the gyroscope, so that you don't have to, so you can reduce the trap flux in the gyroscope. And it's also the major contributor to the attenuation of external fields. We then wrap a spacecraft around the doer and instrument, and we also have a sunshade to keep the light from the sun from reaching the telescope. We point it toward the guide star, and then it slowly rotates about the line of sight to the guide star. Okay, these next 3 charts are just a restatement of the requirements. But what I wanted to point out was that there was little or no flight heritage for these technologies at the beginning of Gravity Probe B, so they had to be developed within the context of the program. I'll jump forward. There are 2 other requirements which I haven't spoken about, and Brad Parkinson will speak more about them. That is, there's some requirements on the space vehicle as well. But in the end, after we put it all together, the performance of these technologies were verified on the ground, in most cases by test, and in some cases by simulation and analysis before flight. So now I'm going to turn to the on-orbit performance, which we were able to verify most of these requirements on orbit. First of all, the spin-up of the gyroscopes. We spun up gyroscopes 2, 3, and 4. They're spinning at 100 down to about 75 hertz. We then spun up gyroscope number 1 last. It's spinning at a low spin speed, We applied the helium gas to the gas spin-up channel. The gyroscope spun up to about 80 hertz. We turned off the gas, and then the gyroscopes coasted from that point on, since the pressure was now low. Because there was, during the spin-up, there was leakage gas into the probe, and therefore the other three gyroscopes had some gas damping, and so they spun down somewhat during this last spin-up. We then went through a low-temperature ultra-high vacuum bakeout because we're using helium gas to spin up the gyroscope, and so helium gas is adsorbed in all the surfaces. And the way that process works is you open a valve to space for the probe, and you increase the temperature of all the low-temperature surfaces from about 2.5 Kelvin up to 6.5 to 7 Kelvin, and the gas devolves from the surfaces and is pumped to space. And then after it soaks for a while, you close the valve, you cool it back down to 2.5 Kelvin, all of the low temperature surfaces, and the small amount of residual gas is adsorbed onto the surfaces very strongly, and the pressure is quite low. In fact, we were able to infer that the pressure is well under 10 to the minus 13 torr, way below our requirement, and our estimate is that it's on the order of 10 to the minus 14 torr. Okay, now the mass imbalance, or the difference between the center of mass and the center of support of the gyroscope, is very important because that's one of the disturbance torque contributors. And this illustrates how we were able to measure it on orbit. This is the mass imbalance when it's lined up with the spin direction. And this is a force that is applied to keep it centered. And this moment will act in such a way to cause a classical precession torr of the gyroscope. However, because of pole hooding, the spin vector moves in the body of the gyroscope in such a way that it actually goes through very large angles because the principal moments of inertia are not equal for this gyroscope. Because of this large angle, this mass imbalance actually becomes transverse to the spin direction. And you can actually measure the magnitude of that because it causes a wobble in the position of the gyroscope at spin speed. We measured that as a function of pole hold, and it turns out that it goes through a maximum when it is transverse. And the on-orbit data found in this way varies between 10 and 9 nanometers. We had a 50 nanometer requirement, which is, so we did very well in this particular performance requirement. I won't talk to this, but the gyro charge control worked very well. It turns out you have to do two things. You have to remove the initial charge, which is a few tenths of a millivolt, of a volt. By the way, one millivolt corresponds to one picocoulomb because we have 1,000 picofarad capacitance of the rotor to ground. And we also have to remove charging due to penetrating particle radiation, which accumulates at about 1/10 millivolt per day on the rotor. But we're able to, as this diagram shows, here's the discharge at two different times for the initial discharge, and we're able to come down to the voltage level or charge level required and to control it to 5 picokelvin, which was under our 15 picocoulomb requirement. The DC squid readout system worked extremely well. This shows the power spectral density in amplitude, not power, but in amplitude, in arc seconds per root hertz as a function of Fourier frequency. This is the roll frequency, this vertical line, and this was a requirement of 190 milliarc seconds per root hertz. And three of the four gyroscopes met the spec quite handily, and one is slightly out, but was quite acceptable because we have a fair amount of conservatism in our requirements. So if one doesn't quite make it, you're okay. This shows a readout of a gyroscope number three during half an orbit when the guide star is in the field of view. During the other half of the orbit, the guide star is occulted by the Earth. And what one sees, the output of the gyroscope readout system is here. They're just dots because it's sample data. and you see the oscillation at roll frequency. And there are two parts to this. There's a constant part, which for this particular half an orbit is basically the current average gyro orientation during that half of an orbit. And then there's a part modulated at orbit, which is due to the aberration of the guide star light. And you see its amplitude, derived amplitude here. And this can be used for scale factor calibration because we have on board very accurate orbital velocity determination and position using the global positioning system receiver. We're also able to measure the trapped flux, magnetic flux on orbit, again, using the fact that the spin vector pole holds in the body of the gyroscope. And so the primary readout measures the angle, but we also have a secondary readout which measures the rotating flux through the loop. And sometimes that goes through a maximum, and this shows the rotating flux. This is the spin speed. It isn't quite periodic because imposed on this is a 110 hertz calibration signal, which hasn't been removed. But otherwise, for the short time, it would be periodic. And from that, we can derive the trapped magnetic flux equivalent as a uniform field within the gyroscope. And it varies between 3 microgauss and 2/10 microgauss. And the trapped magnetic flux is well below our 9 microgauss requirement. Okay, now we did have an issue, namely the patch effect and macroscopic manifestation of the patch effect. When we spun, in this case, gyroscope number 1, at slow speed at 1.3 hertz, the position control system had a bandwidth of a half a hertz. And we found that there was force modulation at spin frequency on the gyroscope on the order of 10 to the minus 7 newtons. And it had a pole hold modulation for this amplitude on top of that. And this could not be explained by the shape characteristics of the gyroscope, but instead clearly was something electrical, and we've attributed it to the a dipole on the gyroscope spinning. And it's explained by a patch effect of approximately 100 millivolts on the rotor. There was also another manifestation, which I won't go into, but there are three consequences of this. One is it's a source of spin-down torque for the gyroscope, pole hood damping, and misalignment torque. Mike Kaiser will talk about the misalignment torque. This is a simple model of the spin-down. There are electrodes surrounding the gyroscope. Here's the spin direction of the gyroscope. And imagine a dipole, which is spinning. This produces currents through a resistor, which in our case happens to be 300 megohms. And these spin-down damping times between 7,000 and 26,000 years for the 4 gyroscopes is accounted for by a dipole voltage of 40 to 80 millivolts. And it turns out this wasn't expected, but the magnitude is actually what we assigned to gas damping, and so we met the damping time in any case, in spite of this new phenomenon. I won't speak about this very much. This is the pole hold period of the 4 gyroscopes in hours versus elapsed time during the mission. And 2 of them do go through through the separatrix. You see this spike in the period. It turns out that what I just spoke about, the spin damping, it is modulated at pole hold frequency. And it only takes a 2% modulation of pole hold frequency to account for this damping. Okay, now let's turn to the star tracking telescope. Here I showed it earlier. Now, how does one read this out? Just in front of the image, which is up at this end, there is a beam splitter, and then there are 2 roof prisms, which are right angles with respect to one another. And the reason they're right angles is because we have to have two axes of readout for the telescope. When the star tracking telescope is centered on the guide star, it falls on this roof prism, and half of the light is reflected off each side of the roof prism. It then goes down to a photodetector, one on each side. The current from this we call I plus, the current from this I minus. And here is a photograph of the photo detectors with their JFET preamplifiers. They operate at 72 Kelvin, while the base is at about 2 Kelvin on the front end of the telescope. And there's a thermal, there's a capped-on structure which thermally isolates it from the telescope. What we do is we take the difference between those two currents, two photocurrents, a weighted difference, and divided by the weighted sum. And the reason it's weighted is because the efficiencies of transport to the photo detectors is slightly different for the two sides, so you have to compensate for that. And we can measure that. We go through, we have a readout scale factor match. What we do is we dither the direction to the guide star in two orthogonal directions at two different frequencies, and with a dither amplitude of 60 milliarc seconds. This signal appears both in the gyroscope and in the telescope, and we have a good calibration of the gyroscope, and so we can transfer the calibration of the gyroscope back to the telescope. This whole system has a 30 milliarc second per root hertz pointing noise below, so just a bit below our requirement. The telescope was not perfect. In fact, it was out of. This is the normalized telescope pointing signal versus a pointing angle, which was derived from the gyroscopes, and the dots are the data. And in order to fit this curve, there's a defocus and also a fourth-order Zernike correction. And this was done with a Fresnel model of the telescope. And this is the relationship between pointing angle and the normalized telescope pointing signal derived from this information. And there's a cubic correction term. Now, we're able to measure the nonlinearity on orbit more precisely than shown before. It turns out one can measure an apparent linear scale factor versus the mean square normalized telescope pointing signal. And Matt Kaiser did this in data analysis by scale factor matching, assuming a linear scale factor for the telescope. Well, it turns out that you can reproduce this curve using only the telescope data and putting in a nonlinearity, and you get the same curve, and from this you get a more accurate determination of the nonlinearity, which happens to be actually quite close to this very wide angle measurement of the telescope. But the net result is that at 400 milliarc seconds, the point need accuracy is 1.7 milliarc seconds. But when you take into account the actual RMS variations of the pointing and the averaging that's involved, the pointing accuracy in inertial space is approximately 1/10 milliarc second. Okay, in conclusion, even though many technologies were initially unavailable, state-of-the-art technologies that we needed, and lacked flight or laboratory heritage, the challenging performance, at least those of those we anticipated in the science instrument, were fully met. And we did have built-in instrument capability and calibrations, which allowed for the identification of unexpected behavior. And in fact, that's how we identified the misalignment patch effect at torque, which Mac will talk about more, and how one separates that from the GR precessions. Now, the bottom line is shown down here. We wanted to build an instrument in which the dominant motion of the gyroscope were the precessions of the general relativistic precessions. This figure shows the position of gyroscope number 4 as a function of mission time. And red is the uncorrected gyro position. And you can just barely see it, but it's a wiggly line. And then underneath of it, there is a blue line, which is the estimated geodetic effect. And it's absolutely clear that the dominant motion of the gyroscope is due to the geodetic effect. This is for the north-south direction, which is the geodetic direction of the geodetic effect. And so we've at least gone a long way toward our goal. But of course, what Mac will talk about, the the misalignment torque due to the patch effect is an issue that we're working on. Thank you. We had a couple different ways of doing that, but the way we actually did it was we used conventional gyroscopes on a platform that was quite relatively well connected to the instrument, and used this to maintain the attitude position during the while the star was occulted. No, people had thought of it. We just made we made an error in how large it was. We had thought that it was going to be quite small.
But it must have been lots of ground testing.
No. We've done some subsequent tests, and they're very difficult measurements to make. And Dale Gill is going to has a poster on that. Obviously, one of the materials that people like for that is gold, but that is a bit of a problem because we have to test the gyroscopes on the ground. We have to have a coating which you can control electron field emission and arcing, and because you need fairly high voltages, high electric fields to suspend the gyroscope in 1G. And it is important to be able to test it on the ground. But gold would be a possible choice.
So did you have a requirement to cover the patch effect, and did you test it? Did you have a requirement
on the ground? No, we did not.
Is this patch effect stable in time, or does it vary?
We can't be sure, but it varies in time in its effect because of pole holding. Maybe because you get both a different spin part and a different spin average part as the spin direction pole holds in the gyroscope body.
Do you have any data how discharge affects the patch
effect? I mean, is the relationship between the discharge?
No, we
have no information on that. We don't believe there's any effect, but.